ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A warning of the good kind. The stories ahead might make you change the course of your own story. When you get to the end of high school, the choices can feel overwhelming, can't they? What apprenticeship? What course? What career? Will I have kids? Of course, in reality, life has this habit of unfolding in a whole series of interesting and often surprising twists and turns, and sometimes it's a matter of hanging on for the wild ride. And hearing about the wild rides of others certainly helped me in my teens. Although I have to say my teens were a pretty wild ride to start with, but that's a whole other story. Welcome to Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell.
There are people out there that want you to succeed. And the thing about that is that there is enough space for all of us to succeed, right? My success is not just about me. It's actually about all of us succeeding. When I see other young people succeed, oh, I'm getting goosebumps now. Yeah. You know, like when I see other young people succeed, it gives me so much hope. I do little dances and we do little dances in the office and you just drop your mullet to the floor. Like it's all those kinds of things.
Leadership done the Samara Jose way. I love that. Samara's a proud Gudjala, Eastern Gugu Yalanji and Darnley Island woman who is co-founder and leader of Deadly Inspiring Youth Doing Good, or DIDG, in far north Queensland, for and by young people. And recently at a Women of the World or WOW Australia event in Brisbane, high school students joined me to meet Samara and three other kick-ass can-do young women, each of whom saw that something big needed changing in the world, and they discovered that they didn't need to wait for permission, thanks very much, to change that. They could make change happen themselves. Chanel Contos is founder and CEO of Teach Us Consent, this incredibly successful campaign for better consent education in schools, and she's author of Consent Laid Bare, Sex Entitlement and the Distortion of Desire. Isabel Reinecke is executive director and founder of the Grata Fund, supporting communities to build landmark legal cases to fight injustices and protect human rights. And Sarah Brown is a Maori woman and co-founder of She Is Not Your Rehab with her husband Matt, supporting men to heal from childhood trauma and abuse without turning to violence. So let's head now to join a theatre full of high school girls at the Queensland Performing Arts Centre on Turrbal and Yuggera land in Meanjin, Brisbane, to meet them.
When you were in year 10, 11... what were you thinking your future might be? Isabel?
Thinking back to when I was your age, I'm in my mid-30s now, I actually had no idea what I was going to do. I was honestly really focused on doing well at school, hanging out with my friends, having a good time. I was certainly aware of social justice issues in my life, in the lives of people in the Australian community, and, you know, had an interest, but I wasn't sort of passionately thinking I was going to go start a nonprofit organisation that does what I do now. I thought I was going to be a psychologist. I sort of was the person that friends would come to talk about problems in their lives, of which you have a lot when you're 16. And that was sort of the journey I went on. I did psychology and law because somebody came and spoke to my school and said, law is a really good thing for teaching you ways of thinking. And I agree with that. It taught me ways of thinking. And I think ultimately what I've ended up doing, which is more leaning on my law training than my psychology training, but reflects the truth about both of those disciplines, is that really law and psychology is about people and about how we interact with one another, how governments interact with us, and how we can hold governments ultimately accountable for how they impact our lives. And I think that's kind of the nugget that's really stayed with me from when I was, you know, 15, of being passionate about, you know, people and how we interact as a community, and ultimately now how we can make sure that governments and corporate leaders also respect our communities.
It's an intriguing beginning of the journey, isn't it? It's interesting. I did engineering at university, and that's what they said to me too, that engineering will teach you how to think critically as well. So that's fascinating to me. Chanel, what about you? Where were you at when you were 15 and 16, 17?
When I was that age, I definitely had a lot of passion for kind of social justice and like different forms, you know, always like volunteering, doing charity committee stuff. Like it was definitely there, but I never thought that it was possible to make a sort of career out of it or actually take that passion and run with it. I think at that age I had a very specific idea around what education was for, and it was kind of taught to me as like, this is for the purpose so that you can go to uni, so that you could do this, so that you can get a job. And then that meant my first degree I did was actually an IT degree, which is quite funny. And I was like very determined to crack a male-dominated industry and like make a mark in that. And then I really didn't like it. And then so I did an arts degree where I learnt incredible things and learnt about the idea of education for the purpose of kind of just self-growth rather than to earn money or to have an end goal from it. Which is why I decided to do my master's in gender. And everyone was like, what are you doing? You know, it's a waste of time. It's a waste of money. It's such a like stereotype around kind of like gender studies or feminists and things like that. But yeah, it was the most valuable thing I ever did. And all of this came from it, from just the passion rather than trying to follow any sort of like set path or money or anything.
That's such a great point about education. We kind of lose sight of that sometimes when we're in classrooms, don't we? That education is about self-growth and kind of revealing the world to us and, yeah, revealing all the possibilities for ourselves in the world. Samara, how about you? Where were you at 15, 16?
A very different place. I was not somebody who believed in my own abilities. Mm. I really struggled. I had lots of self-doubt, and I actually had a mentor, a teacher of mine, and there was an Indigenous youth leadership program running at our school, and he comes up to me and I'm sitting on the bench at, you know, lunch, chilling out with all the friends, and he goes, you better be at that meeting for leadership next break. And I went, okay, sure, rightio. And I think for me that was the catalyst. It was a catalyst into a world, into something that I'd never thought or saw of myself. You know, I was always a good kid. I wasn't bad or anything. I just wasn't driven. I wasn't motivated. I didn't know where I was going in the world. I didn't know what my purpose was. And I didn't know what I had to contribute. And participating in a leadership program like that helped me to kind of open my doors and taught me a lot about my strength. I have an ability to talk some stuff and, you know, like to play around and have fun and have jokes but to teach other people about our community, our culture, our families. And so through that, recognising that when we as a collective of young people come together and we don't necessarily have to know what we want to do, but we know we want to change something. We know that something doesn't feel right. And then the ideas came from that after school, you know. It was that leadership program and being a graduate of it, it just made me, I held on to those people who were like me in that we know we want to do something, but we just don't know what. And we don't know how, and we don't know, there are a lot more we don't knows than we did know. And that was really kind of a whole process. And when you're figuring that out, a lot of people who told me, because I had an ability to talk and had an ability to, you know, pull people in and yarn with other students, that you should become a teacher. So I went and did a semester of teaching, went and did my first prac. Love all you teachers in the audience. I honestly believe you deserve a pay rise.
Yes.
Because it is a challenge every single day to show up and be present for a whole cohort of young people who are like I was, hormonal and challenging and self-righteous and, you know, going through the whole identity crisis of being a teenager. Like, our teachers are, you have so much influence and so much power to shift the way, the trajectory of a young person. And I think that's really powerful.
But it's interesting, you show up every day for young people. Yeah. But the other thing that strikes me about what you've just shared with us is that someone saw you when you didn't see yourself.
Yeah.
And that's amazing to me, you know, and that it's kind of an interesting process that, isn't it? Sometimes people just see you without you even putting your hand up to be seen. But other times it's also about finding someone who can help you see yourself, like being almost proactive. Who's going to be my champion?
Yeah.
especially when things are difficult, maybe at home or wherever. It's like, who's going to be my champion?
And there are people out there, and I think that's the hardest thing sometimes is when you're young, you think nobody's on your side. Nobody cares enough to help you to push through some sort of barrier.
Yeah.
But there are, and they want you to succeed.
Sarah Brown, what about you? Where were you at 15, 16?
My story again was very different. I was just trying to survive. At 15 years of age, I had already left home. I was working two jobs to try and support myself. I did not come from an ideal family. I had been adopted from my biological family, disconnected from my culture, and I was being raised in an incredibly abusive environment. I was traumatized. I was struggling. I had very little self-worth, and I ended up becoming a pregnant teenager. So that's where I started my life. And I guess my message and the heart of what we do now is encouraging people that it doesn't matter where you start, it doesn't matter that where you begin, if it is in a home like mine, actually that's just a start, that's the first page. You have a whole story to write. My story now is incredibly different, and I've been able to be the mother for my children that I never received myself. I guess my message is one of telling those out there that don't come from ideal families and schools and they don't have all the support that it is possible to be. It's possible to be everything you never received. It's possible to be to change the narrative, to break cycles of intergenerational trauma, abuse, dysfunction, and be completely different.
Mm-hmm. Let's then get a sense of what you're all doing now and what was the problem that you wanted to solve. So what was the problem that you have found yourself solving, and I guess just a kernel of how you got there? She Is Not Your Rehab is working in jails. You're distributing your book, She Is Not Your Rehab, in jails. You and your husband, Matt, tour the world. You're just about to take two of your little ones to India and elsewhere around the world and Europe to really spread this message that intergenerational trauma can be healed in some way and violence is not the answer.
Yes. So I guess my life's journey from being a pregnant teenager, that was sort of the start of the invitation to do the work in my own life. I remember looking down at my baby that I had, and I had never looked even after a child, so I didn't even really know what I was doing. I remember I looked at her and I thought, I want more for you than I had in my life. And so that would require me to do the work to heal, to be the kind of mother that she deserved. I hadn't seen a good mother. I didn't have one. And so I embarked on my own journey. So realistically, when we talk about all the things we've done now, that's come from a very real place of doing the inner work myself to heal the pain and the trauma that my ancestors could not heal in our family line. And so when I met my husband finally many years later, I already had a daughter by then, he came from his own home of dysfunction, abuse, domestic violence, sexual abuse as a child. And together, I mean, what a recipe for success. We had to have done the individual work ourselves. And I really believe that everything we've done now has been the external, you know, response to the internal work we already did prior. It had to come from a real place. So we started a barbershop. My husband was a prolific barber. He became very well known.
It's stunning yes. Haircuts. Like, there's probably a whole language around the haircuts that he did.
Well, he was kind of a famous hair artist. Around the world, he was known in the barbering industry. He got famous because he did a picture of Tupac, one of our favourite rappers, on a brother's head, and it went viral, and the Tupac official page in America reshared it. And so he kind of got this, like, you know, big ups kind of thing, and his story kind of went out there. But he really utilised his barbershop and his, you know, his success as a hair artist to talk about real things, about domestic violence, about trauma, about sexual abuse, about the epidemic that was plaguing our community. And that was really what it was. It was just a vehicle to the work. So I guess when you look at the problem we're solving now, I mean, I hope that we can eradicate domestic violence. I think it's, you know, it's evil that we have children living in homes in 2023 where they are with dysregulated adults who are harming them, you know, and that stems back from, again, intergenerational trauma where people are hurt people. There's pain that must be felt. And they, you know, what is not transformed is transmitted onto the most vulnerable in our community. So I guess the problem we're trying to solve is to heal the world.
Yeah.
Heal the world.
Wow. Epic and brilliant. I'll come to Chanel because you really started to interrogate the violence in our very first and formative intimate relationships, didn't you? So where did that begin with Teach Us Consent? 2 years ago. I cannot believe it's only 2 years.
Well, actually, funny we're talking about like in this context because, yes, I posted on Instagram 2 years ago. I had the idea for this kind of type of campaign or action 3 years ago. It took me a year to like think about doing anything public with it. But the first time I ever advocated for consent education was actually when I was 15 years old and when I received consent education for the first time. Because
how was that?
It didn't go down so well. But it was basically me and my friends, we got this consent education talk. In hindsight, it was definitely like absolutely riddled with like problems and stereotypes. And it definitely wasn't the best form of delivery or, you know, whatever. But bottom line is, these really important things were communicated to us. You know, we found out that intoxication makes consent void. We found out that oral sex can count as rape. We found out that someone that you, you know, love and trust or like or have a crush on can sexually assault you. And ultimately, we found out that consent was required in a sexual act for it to not be one of sexual assault. And this was mind-blowing to me and my peers. And because me and my friends had a collective realization in that room on that day that so many of us had been sexually assaulted, which I also see every single time I go into schools. I actually obviously love what I do, but I do dread going into girls' schools because I know that someone in that room is going to have that exact feeling because I know that it's going to be the first time they're hearing about this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you can see it in kind of like their faces or, you know, the way they act or the messages they send after. But yeah, me and my two best friends went to a teacher at the school next day after kind of like decompressing and thinking about speaking to each other about all these things. We basically said, that was incredible. It was, you know, that was the best. I still think it was the best talk I ever had or like educational experience I ever had at school. But we needed to hear it earlier. We told them that it happened too late. And we basically got told that we were mature for the year and these sort of things happened to us, but not others. Which is also like completely untrue because it was something that definitely spanned across the whole grade, which I only learned as I got older and friends from all different sort of like, you know, groups and across the years sent me testimonies. But yeah, and then they also said we would never get it past the parents, so they wouldn't agree to teach this content any earlier. So we left and we forgot about it. And I, yeah, didn't think about consent education for many years until it all then started again.
And so you're doing your master's in London, I think, yeah?
I'm finished now, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You were doing your master's in London on gender studies and you put a post on Instagram. What, this is 2 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah, February 2021.
Right. So just at the, well, yeah, year two of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so you put the post and then what happens?
So I post on Instagram saying, have you or anyone close to you ever been sexually assaulted by someone who went to an all-boys school in Sydney? It's very specific because I kind of never even envisioned that I would have this sort of kind of like national impact. And my original plan was to just go to these all-boys schools that, you know, my school used to socialize with, like that I knew of the principals of or whatever, and hand them these testimonies. And in 24 hours, over 200 people said yes. And then I asked people to send me testimonies of sexual assault. And it was a really interesting thing where, and also in the testimonies, I asked that people name the school of the perpetrator and the victim and the school year, but not any individual names. And that was for the intention of drawing attention to how pervasive this is, how it's, you know, so directly in front of you. Also getting the attention of the school system, making it feel very real and close to home, but never trying to scapegoat any individuals. Something that I really resonated with when I was hearing your husband speak last night, Sarah, was this idea of like, how can we not, you can't grow in shame. So how can we, there's no point trying to shame all the things that have already happened, but how can we look forward and try to prevent?
From 200 stories sent to you or responses to that question, you're now upwards of 7,000 stories, probably more.
Yeah.
And what has resulted?
Consent education is now mandated in all Australian schools from kindergarten to year 10 every year. It's pretty cool.
Kindergarten to year 10, it's required every school, no matter what.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Chanel. And you've worked with the New South Wales Police.
Yeah, we worked on launching an alternative reporting option to sexual violence because the criminal system just doesn't... I think that the way our criminal system works to attempt to prosecute these crimes, specifically peer-on-peer teenage sexual violence that often occurs out of kind of like entitlement and apathy rather than any form of malice. I think we've essentially decriminalised rape in Australia, which is really concerning to me. So there needs to be a full overhaul of the system.
And even when it does get into the courts, some women are listened to and some women aren't at all.
Mm. Exactly. There's very disproportionate...
Based on their backgrounds, their experiences, prejudices police might have, etc. Very powerful work. Teach Us Consent is the website. Isabel Reinicke, Executive Director and Founder of the Grata Fund. So tell me about then how you came to set up the Grata Fund and what you feel your successes have been.
So I can't give you a kind of a neatly packaged answer. And as I said, you know, when I was your age, I really didn't know. And I didn't know until I was doing what I was doing that this is what I wanted to be doing in a way. And I think that's an important thing for people to know that, you know, looking forward to, you know, women who are at our point, it can be, I think, sometimes a little bit intimidating to think like, how do I, you know, get to the point where I'm doing something with purpose that I really care about and believe in? And I think probably all of us have sort of fumbled our way towards what we're doing. I certainly have. And I've always just looked at like, what's the step, the immediate step in front of me and just focus on the next step and the next step. And for me, that has meant Grata Fund. And
what was the idea?
So because of that step-by-step approach, what that meant is I was exposed to lots of different things and ways of doing things in the world. So I started my career as a corporate lawyer very much thinking I'd go in and out, get my training, move on, and that is what I did. But the real impetus to move on and know what the next step would be was I went and worked in East Kimberley on stolen wages reparations. So if you're not familiar with this fact, across Australia, Aboriginal people worked but were paid different amounts in different states. But in WA, it was a dollar a day. But nobody actually received the dollar a day. The dollar a day went to the government and the government held that money on trust because people were not, you know, given the ability to actually manage their own money by the government. And eventually the Equal Pay Act came in the 70s and people were kicked off the missions and the reserves and really their land that they were working on for that dollar a day that wasn't paid, and then went and set up town camps, so places like Kununurra, which is sort of gives you context to understand then how, you know, how the world develops from that point. But I went and I worked with clients in East Kimberley because the WA government had decided to do a reparations process, and they were going to give people $2,000 each if you could, you know, satisfy that you'd been had your money stolen from you, basically, which is terrible in itself. And what that meant is that I spent, you know, a lot of time as a young lawyer, you know, basically taking oral histories of people in East Kimberley who had had their wages stolen and had conducted backbreaking work and suffered unspeakable traumas in their lives. And that really...
Very hard for them to get a hearing in the courts, in government.
It just showed me really firsthand how much white systems or colonial systems of law were not serving at all the people that they even were trying to at that point. You know, equal pay, for example, that was designed in part to try and resolve this problem. It actually just worsened the problem, for example. And same with the reparation system caused, you know, trauma for people having to relive those stories to a white outsider. That's problematic in itself. But I then went and I worked in a campaigning organisation on, you know, other systemic social justice issues. But really what I then saw was, you know, there is this tool of law, and if you have the money and the access, it is very, very powerful to help you secure your rights. So if you are Woolworths, you have the best lawyers in the world to secure your rights as the board or the, you know, the company of Woolworths. But if you are a First Nations person living in remote WA, who's had your wages stolen and suffered unspeakable harms, you know, you don't have that access, and that just doesn't make sense to me. And you might have, you know, legal services organisations, and we have amazing legal service organisations that are day in, day out working for communities to deal with injustices that they're facing, you know, over-policing, over-suspension from school, over-incarceration by our systems. But for me, I saw that, you know, with litigation, you actually have the opportunity to create big systemic change, because we can hold, as a society, our governments and corporate leaders accountable in the same way that the government is able to hold us accountable. So, you know, they can send us to jail if we break a law. Okay, well, we can also hold them accountable as a community to that same law if we are provided with access. And so for me, it really became with Grata about figuring out what are the gaps that are missing to make it possible for people who traditionally don't have access to that power to actually hold governments accountable. And just to give you an example of a win, a really recent win, which is really incredible and speaks to that, is a community in the Territory named Laramba. They are about 2 hours west of Alice Springs on a red dirt road. They live in housing that is rented from the Northern Territory government for extremely expensive prices, and they are forced to drink water from their taps that has uranium in it. Not just uranium at 2.5 times the safe drinking level. And I don't know what a safe drinking level of uranium is, but I don't want it. And neither do people in Laramba. And they called on the government for years to do something about this, and the government just did nothing about it. So they sued them. They sued the government, and we helped them to sue the government. And the government tried to stop the case from happening by putting in a filtration system into the community. And you'd think, okay, good thing, the community now has access to safe water. But actually, really what that is, cynically, is about stopping the community from winning that case, because if they win the case, it changes the law for the whole of all remote communities in the Territory. And they went on and they just won that case. So the Northern Territory government...
Isabel!
Well, it's not me, though.
And the team.
It's and it's the community. And I think that picks up on something everybody said today, which is that, you know, everyone has said it in different ways. You find the people that you connect with, older, younger, your age, and build that community, because there are people who want you to succeed and want others around you to succeed, and you need to really work on harnessing and treasuring those relationships. Some of my close working relationships today are with mentors that I found during university. So there's so much opportunity ahead of you to build that community.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. And of course, you've worked on multiple fronts. Climate change justice as well has been a part of the support that the Grata Fund has.
Yes, we're working with communities in Gutamalagul, which is the northernmost part of the Torres Strait, and want to acknowledge Senior Elder Auntie Macrose Ilu, who's in the audience today, Senior Queenslander of the Year. I'm very lucky to be working with Auntie and her communities to challenge the Australian government over climate change. And they're basically saying the Australian government has a duty of care and they have been negligent in relation to climate change in the Torres Strait. And if they win, it will unlock climate change in Australia forever. Mm. They're asking for the court to find that the government needs to reduce their emissions in line with the science. Mm. And that means that every time the government, if it wins, every time the government tries to open, you know, a new fossil fuel here, a new mine there, a new gas plant here, they won't be able to. You'll be able to take them to court and say, no, this does not actually obey the rights of people in the Torres Strait. So it's a hugely significant case.
Thanks, Isabel. That's the Grata Fund. Samara Jose, a deadly inspiring youth doing good, wellbeing camps, good vibrations, weekly gatherings, narrative therapy, men's groups, mentoring, reconnecting kids back to country and back to education, who, when they've had experience of the youth justice system. So much stuff. Where did Deadly Inspiring Youth Doing Good begin? What was the kernel?
I talk about that leadership program that I was a part of in high school. I had the opportunity to work in it as a project support officer. And our first sort of cohort, our first sort of graduates that exited that program, we were together. And we just were, I was providing a space once a week, voluntary, and you know, it was about bringing good people together, because what we know and what we experienced as young people who have exited high school, who weren't very clear about what we were doing with our lives and with the world, and that we needed a safe space to just be together and to be positive and to think about and have the time and the space to think about what we wanted to do with our lives. But we know we wanted to do something productive in that meantime. So,
And it's interesting. I mean, you're kind of working that out at every age and stage. Like, 100%. I still don't know what I'm doing with my life.
No.
And I'm pretty busy, but yeah. I still don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just, you know, when you find a community that you can have these yarns with, you can build the relationships you feel safe with, then good things come from that.
Yeah.
And that's just like our way as, you know, as First Nations peoples, it's about being as a collective, mm-hmm. being safe in the collective. And that collective safety means that we have the ability to imagine, we have the ability to dream. And so, you know, it sparked from that. And from there, we had a really significant tragedy in our community, where six young people were tragically murdered. And our response in that was to be able to provide safe spaces for young people.
This is in Cairns.
Cairns, in our community.
Yeah.
And so we activated, we held, you know, different activities, sharing culture, you know, basketball competition, games in the park, like simple things that just are about lightness and love and coming together and being together. And from that, I think we really recognised we had a $5,000 grant that was auspiced by a non-Indigenous organisation, and auspicing is auspicing, so you still get your little 20% taken out from it. So of a little $5,000 bucket, they took $500 of it.
Unreal.
And so, but we spread that $5,000 over 6 months, you know, because it was about young people just volunteering and actively being a part of our community. Mm. And all the while, and it's really funny because it's only like later years down the track after this process that I now hear of, you know, the support that was and the advocacy that was happening on our behalf that I didn't know was actually happening for us.
Behind the scenes.
So those champions who actually were supporting us on the ground, we were doing the on-ground work, they were championing us. They were talking about the great work that we were doing as young people and how they saw that this is actually the change that we need. We need to be able to provide these opportunities for young people to do what they need to do in their communities. And so for me, that was a really big shift in, okay, we've done this auspicing. We actually need our own structure. We actually need our own system, our own organisation to be able to do the work that we need to do, whatever it may be, so long as it is centred around our young people. And young people are the centre of our families. They're the centre of our communities. And that for me is what I think, why we have, you know, all of these different projects and programs and things like that that have come off it, because we know that when we heal our uncles and our fathers, that, and they're doing amazing stuff in our community, that they have an ability to share back to our to our families, to our young people, to our community, to our brothers, to our young girls, to keep us safe, to, you know, the whole thing. When we look at Indigenous communities, every single person in our collectives have roles to play. They have roles to play in terms of our safety. They have roles to play in our growth and our development. And what we are trying to emulate is that family, right, in different ways.
And the power of, you know, so often things that you're done to, you know, you get, you know, an initiative, a program given to you, you're sort of done to, I guess is the word that comes to mind, the expression that comes to mind. But this is very much about you do it, you doing the doing.
Doing the doing.
And doing identifying, good. Doing good. Mm-hmm. I love it, Didge. Deadly inspiring youth doing good. But identifying what the best path, what the best process is.
Yep.
That's vital, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think we've all, when I look at our organisation, I look at the people that are in it, that make it what it is, that make it the success story. I'm only one piece of that puzzle. There is a whole team of people and they come with their experiences. But each one of those people that have come with their experiences have been hurt. They've been let down by a system. They've been let down by a process that has disempowered them. What they see all the time is often dysfunction. And so when they come into this space and they're given an opportunity and empowered to go, help create, help reimagine, help to rethink what we do and how we do it. It's not just about this structure being plonked on top of us. It's we have an ability to rethink every single thing that we do, the way that we do business, the way that we build relationships, the way that we support our young people on the ground, the way that we empower staff members to get creative and do the work. It's always from the ground up and it's always from their lived experience.
So these are the incredible stories and the incredible successes. I want to hear one mighty challenge. And I know there have been probably a gazillion mighty challenges, but one mighty challenge that you've had to wrestle with in this whole process of creating what you have. Sarah Brown.
Look, there's been many struggles and many challenges. But to be honest, when we started as a grassroots response in our community, we knew our community needs because we knew the people out of relationship. Trying to constantly advocate to government to get resource to actually fund the work that we knew was desperately needed was a huge, huge milestone. And you're constantly basically pushing shit uphill continually to get anywhere. And so I guess we learned very quickly that do not wait for the government to come and help you because they really don't.
And we
had to find our own way. And even trying to get, like, when we released our book, our goal and our heart was that our book would be made available for every incarcerated person in our country, which at the time was 9,350 people, half of which were Indigenous. And we wanted our book to be given freely. Our publisher at the time was like, well, we want to sell books. Why would we want to give them away? Mm-hmm. And second of all, it was really difficult to work with, again, a corrective system which really didn't prioritise true rehabilitation. So they, you know, don't really allow such things to go in. We had to really get right to the top and, you know, talk to our national commissioner. And basically she allowed the books to get in. And so now our book...
She Is Not Your Rehab.
She Is Not Your Rehab is the number one bestseller of prison because... Everyone has a copy. So it's right up there with the Bible and the Quran. Everyone has a copy. Everyone talks about it. But that investment was so worth it. The time, the labour required to, like, push those systems, to bend those systems, to get letters back from the men inside and from their partners on the outside and their children of how much that impacted them to change the narrative for their lives, it was worth it. So I believe all struggle can be hard, but actually when we really push through, it is worth it at the other side.
And it's the power of story, the power of narratives. Chanel, what about you? One big challenge that you've overcome?
Oh, it's so hard because I feel like I'm still in the middle of so many of them. And then also there's been, like, overwhelming support and love that has kind of, like, you know, counteracted all of the hard times or any sort of negativity. I guess, like, from a personal perspective, the hardest thing was reading almost 7,000 testimonies of sexual assault. That changes the way you think and see the world. And also, because it started on Instagram before we had the website or platform up, a lot of the stories that came in were from girls I knew, which means that they either named or gave away identifying information, which made me know which boys they were too, who I also knew. But of course, it's like a confidential...
So sitting with the weight of that.
And just, like, I mean, yeah, it's you're asking, like, do I live in Sydney, London? It's a big reason that I'm not committed to coming back to Sydney is because I consistently have to see people that I know these things about that I can't reveal and have to act in a way that makes no one else... Because if, you know, I suddenly cut someone out of my life, it would be quite obvious why, I think, with the work I do. So, yeah, that's been really hard to navigate, I think, coming to terms with who has perpetrated these sorts of crimes. But in that same vein, it's the exact sort of thing that I ask other people to do, to think about that it can be people really close to us that we do trust, that, you know, we do love, who do these sorts of things. So having to do that process at scale, I think, was
very tough.
The biggest challenge.
Isabel Reinecke from Grata Fund, what about you? A really brief challenge that you've had to overcome.
Look, I think we could probably all speak for this entire session about the challenges, but the one that I would say is probably most resonant for you guys is being underestimated. I've always been underestimated, always been kind of assumed to, you know, not be bright or not be capable based on, I guess, it says more about those people than it does about me, but... You know, to the point that, you know, even now I have people say to me, oh, no, you didn't found Grata Fund. I met the guy who founded Grata Fund.
Audible gasp from the audience.
Yeah.
From women as well as from men. And that is really annoying. But my dad actually gave me great advice when I was younger, when I was kind of in early days of university. And he said that the sweetest feeling is showing people who have underestimated you mm-hmm. how wrong they are. Mm-hmm. And I really take comfort in that. So when I'm underestimated now, I just think, okay, all right, that's all right. We'll see. Reputation's a long game and I'm here to stick around. So I just say to you that if you feel like you're ever underestimated, just, you know, remember how sweet it's going to feel to you when you prove them wrong later down the yes. track.
Hold on to the self-belief. Samara Jose, what about you?
It is self-doubt. It's the inner dialogue that we tell ourselves that we're not good enough or we can't do it or our problem isn't worth solving or we're not the person to solve that problem. It is, for me, the single most thing that I have to struggle with consistently. And I still do it even in things like this, right? There's self-doubt to go, why am I the person sitting on a panel with amazing women like this?
Because I had that exact same thought.
They're feeling the same way that you know this.
I actually, like, I'm a big advocate for being like, stop asking women about imposter syndrome. And I'm always like, I don't have doubt, I back myself. And I was sitting here being like,
yeah. It's a thing, right? It's not that we can't, we have to learn how to harness that self-doubt, right? Because the nervous energy is good in some ways. It helps us to push through and to go, suck it up, let's go. Okay, use that nervous energy to just pump through things. And sometimes it helps me. It's really good. The nervous energy, I mean. But the self-doubt is obviously still...
Sometimes it's crippling.
It's crippling. Yeah. It's crippling. And sometimes you just kind of, you feel like you don't perform. But the best way to combat that is to have people around you who know you and that go, enough now.
Yes.
You are good at what you do and you will continue to show up. And that's all it is.
It's the showing up sometimes, isn't it? I want to come to you for questions now. We've got a few minutes and then we've got a great performer to round us off. And the other thing I'd say, that just count how many times as women and girls and non-binary people you say sorry in a day. Just do that one day and just write it down how many times you say sorry. I've started to stop saying sorry all the time. Sorry is a beautiful word, but sometimes we overuse it. We apologise for just opening a door, I've noticed, or sitting down. Oh, sorry. Oh, you know, we do that a lot. Let's not do that. But also I'd say that self-doubt is a form of vulnerability, and vulnerability is also our strength because it makes us sensitive to the world and to other people's needs. So let's come to you for questions. We've got a mic. We've got a few. Yes, great. Oh, thank you.
What is your favourite part about starting these programs?
So I'm going to take a couple of questions in a row. Your favourite part about starting these programs?
How do you find the right career?
Yeah, great question. So what is your favourite part about what you do?
That when I see the constant influx of news and injustice in the world, that I have an opportunity to do something with that, and I can go, freaking angry about this thing and it shouldn't be what's happening in the world, but now I have a pathway where I can really harness that energy and anger to do something positive. And I think that's really sustaining in a world that is, you know, has a lot of bad news in it.
Yeah, the power of anger, well channeled, important. Chanel?
My favourite thing about this work is, because I work like quite high level, like structural policy stuff, when I get feedback from individuals of like individual stories of how this work's transformed things for them. So the other day I spoke at a co-ed school, and then afterwards a girl messaged me saying the talk made a boy in the room message her and apologise for all the things he'd done to her. And like... That just made me really happy, because I think that's going to change the trajectory of both his and her life, and that's really nice. And then also, like I wrote a book this year, it got published this year, and the last chapter is called For Boys and Men, and just getting messages from like 14-year-old boys being like, you know, my mum gave me that chapter and now I'm going to read the whole book, or like 50-year-old dads being like, I bought it for my daughters and I flicked through a few pages and now I'm, you know, investing in the whole thing. And
amazing.
Yeah.
And so Chanel's book is called Consent Laid Bare, Sex Entitlement and the Distortion of Desire, if you want to pick up a copy.
I wish I had that at your age. Not to shameless plug, but I really, really do wish I had that at your age. So
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Samara, what about you?
I'll answer two questions at once. Cool. One is I love that I get paid to do what I love. And I think that the... doing what I love is absolutely just seeing young people when they have that moment of self-belief and self-confidence that they are doing the right thing. And that's powerful. And to end up in the career that I ended up in, I think it was actually volunteering, right? So I did a lot of this work actually just testing out a whole bunch of things and listening to people who knew a lot more things that I didn't know. And so being in their spaces helped me to just go, I like that part of it, but I don't like that part job, you know? So figure out what you don't like. It helps to narrow down what you're going to do like.
Yeah, good point. Sarah, if you want to have a double-barreled answer,
yeah,
go for
sure. I absolutely love getting feedback from the children of the men that we support to do the healing work. You know, we receive beautiful messages from children saying things like, thank you for helping my dad to heal. My dad's apologised to my mum for what he's done. He's come out of jail. He doesn't want to go back. He wants to be a different kind of dad. We received one letter from a boy who said that his dad got out of jail. He had read our book inside. And he said that he came into bed one night. He was, you know, going to sleep, and his dad came in and he said, I just want to come and tell you that I love you. And that was the first time he'd ever heard him say, I love you. And he said, I just want you to know that I'm trying my best to do the work. I've read this book inside and it's helping me change, but I want to be a better dad for you. And so hearing stories like that, it just makes all the hard work worth it. To the question about how to know what career you do, you know what? I don't even think you have to have one career in this life. I have like a multiple. I do all kinds of jobs all rolled into one. But my my encouragement is that actually just follow your curiosity. Do what you enjoy. Be curious about the things that you enjoy in life. Do them without even thinking about the career side. And I think you just end up being right where you're meant to be.
Sometimes what you enjoy changes. You try something else, you don't enjoy it.
I've done so many jobs. I've literally had 100 jobs. So,
And just final comment to you two about how do you know what you want to do?
I just completely agree with these answers. It's just you foot one step after the other, you know, one foot after the other, look at the next step ahead of you, follow your interests.
Follow your interests. It'll work out.
It'll have a narrative that makes sense to you in 15 years maybe. It won't make sense until you get to that point. So just trust that you'll get there eventually.
And try something.
Yeah, I think also the reason I was like, oh, I don't know how to answer that is because this idea of a career is you kind of think like, I need to plan, I need to set this out, I need to think 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and like, what are the steps you need to take there? But it really is just, follow your curiosity, follow your passions, and you'll just like end up in a place and don't think about the kind of like end goal, just like take it as it comes.
Yeah. I feel really honoured to share this conversation with these four incredible women, all of you doing remarkable work and building a community around you to enable you to do that work too seems to be a really vital part of it. I want you to thank Samara Jose from Deadly Inspiring Youth Doing Good, Chanel Contos, Teach Us Consent, Isabel Reinicke Gratifund, Sarah Brown from New Zealand, She Is Not Your Rehab. And now we have a very, very, very special thing to conclude today's event. But of course, you're heading off onto the rest of your day here at the Women of the World Festival 2023. We have Lamis Hamuda, who is a youth worker. She is a poet and she has just published her first book. It's called The Shape of Dust. Look, it gives me the shivers saying that. And she's co-authored it, I think, with her father as well. Please give a big, warm Brisbane welcome to Lamis.
I felt deeply resonant with everyone on the panel from your discussion of prison. The book that I co-authored with my father is about his imprisonment, and so that's something that's very close to home, from working with young people to doing your master's in gender studies. I also started a master's in gender studies before my dad went to prison, so that really, it also deeply impacted me. And your work with the Grata Fund, I'm pretty sure you know Jennifer Robinson, and she helped with getting my father out of prison. So, you know, everyone on this panel, I really deeply resonate with all the work that you do and really connected with it. So thank you. So I was tasked with writing a poem. I'm Egyptian background, and there's an Arab poetry form called the ghazal. And the ghazal is known colloquially as a love poem. And it has some very specific guidelines to it. And part of the ghazal is it's a performance poem that often invites audience involvement. And that audience involvement is picking up the last two words of the second stanza I'll like read it to you, and echoing it back when it comes up. So if you figure out the rhythm without me needing to explain much further, feel free to resonate on the last two words, which are a treaty. Okay? Contradictory conditions of lease, believe, landed feet can't wait much longer for a treaty. You cannot grow in shame, release the punished gaze. Consent from bodies to land equals a treaty. Pollies think they feast, but it is we who are rich. Collectives in lightness and love, this is a treaty. Red dirt streets running with uranium water, Larambe's law shows we're thirsty for a treaty. Words gutted of meaning, falling from the mouthpiece, no more crumbs, no more referendums, a treaty. Here, take the poet's name, Lamise, soft to the touch. To be what this land deserves, love is a treaty. Thank you.
Lamise Hamuda.
Wow, Lamise Hamuda's book with her father is called The Shape of Dust. It was published in 2023 by Pantera Press. And big thanks to Lamise and to Chanel Contos, Isabel Reinecke, Samara Jose and Sarah Brown, and to the Women of the World Australia Festival team. They are wonderful to work with. It was lovely meeting the high school students in the room for this event with their teachers. Up next on Big Ideas, it's a queer love letter to libraries.
In 1992, when my dad banned me from purchasing Dolly magazine ever again, I knew I could always read them at the library. For some reason, he didn't think his 11-year-old should be reading about the adult concepts found within its pages. His assessment being that I would presumably deem it as a to-do list or some kind of sick instruction manual. Then in 1993, I was sent to a deeply intimidating single-sex high school where I didn't fit in and wasn't sure where to go when we had all that time to ourselves. There was always the dappled light in the stacks at the school library. It was this calm, vacuum-sealed oasis where you didn't have to think of anything to say and you could curl up with a book where no one could see you. I was never lonely there. Sound was cushioned by all that wisdom on all those pages that I could quietly absorb one by one.
That's author Jasper Peach with their queer love letter to libraries. It's a lovely discussion up next on Big Ideas. Don't miss it. And you can find and follow Big Ideas so you don't miss any of our episodes on the ABC Listen mobile app. Just look for your mobile phone's app store, download ABC Listen, and then search for Big Ideas and follow us that way. And that helps more people find us too. So, please do that. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Really great to have you company today for Big Ideas. And I will catch you next time. Go well.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.